Hey guys, it's The Great Debates.
Yes.
Republican National Convention, day two.
RNC.
Cleveland.
Well, technically it's day four, but it's our day two.
Yeah, baby. It's Thursday.
There wasn't much point being here before.
This is the day.
Today's the day. Davis,
cometh the hour, cometh the man.
Have you seen Trump speak before?
Well, as a matter of fact, I've met Donald Trump a couple times.
Is that right?
Well, I used to work for Last Call at Carson Daly, and he was a guest a couple times, I believe. Yeah. And we hung out.
What'd you think?
Stone cold weirdo.
Did he ever say anything weird in
particular? No, I mean, he's just like you think he is. Nothing different.
Odd.
I'm pretty sure. Now I can't remember. Also, we had the... Whatever, who cares?
At no time did it cross your mind that man could be the president of the United States.
No, never.
Not even an inkling, a glimmer in his eye, your eye.
There was also, I'm just remembering, might as well throw this out there, an early on, before The Apprentice was on TV, we had these people come to the show, and they was like, these are Donald Trump's people, there's some new game show he's doing, and there was like a task-oriented thing, they had to do something with Carson. Were you there at the time?
Don't recall that.
But Omarosa was one of the people who was there, I'm pretty sure. And we were like, what is going on? This somehow involves Donald Trump later. And it's like, yeah, there's a show called The Apprentice. He's going to, I don't know, hire one of them eventually. It was very strange.
That's where it all started.
Well, started with the loan from his dad.
Are we ready for a micro?
Guess what?
We're failing to jump into it.
Guess what?
Started with a $1 million loan from my dad. Now I'm here.
Technically, we're in the middle of a two-part series, so I don't think we're at the beginning of a new episode. But that being said, like, let's get into it with a micro. 3 minutes on the clock. Steve Healy taking the pro.
Okay.
The president runs the country.
I'm Steve Healy, and I'm taking the pro. The president is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. That right there, he's running the military arm of the biggest empire the world has ever seen. But more importantly than that, the president sets the agenda just by being the president, by going on television, by holding the office, by having the ability to introduce legislation, by having the ability to appoint Supreme Court justices, by having the ability to manipulate the economy through the direction of the Treasury Department. In a million small and large ways, the president runs the country. Now, the president, he or she can reduce or increase the amount of influence they have on the nation, but here is a person who has in their power the ability to run the national agenda, indeed the world agenda.
What a bunch of hogwash. Let's go point by point. He runs the army. Well, he can't declare war. He or she, only Congress can declare war. You know that, Healy.
Okay, we've seen many times. When's the last time we declared war? And yet we have troops engaged all over the place overseas.
The last time we declared war, I believe, was when we declared war in Iraq because our president lied to us, as did many other members of the administration. It certainly wasn't the job of one person, being George W. Bush. It took Dick Cheney and Colin Powell and a number of people who came up with this
Fakakta
yellow cake story. No, I would argue Dick Cheney's underlings. I would actually argue that at the time, the president was one of Dick Cheney's underlings. You also said he gets to go on television. Obviously, there's like probably 400 people who appear on television more often than the president. They could have just as easy a time influencing people as the president does. You mentioned that they get to appoint Supreme Court justices. Not always the case. In fact, it's quite random how many members of the Supreme Court they are able to nominate. And in fact, now that they are nominating and appointing judges who are younger and younger, we may in fact see that after the next 8 to 10 years, it may be quite some time before the president is actually nominating any more Supreme Court justices. We may see a large gap in
that. That's just a testament to the far-reaching influence of the president. It can extend beyond his or her presidency.
You also said that he gets to introduce legislation, but of course, if the Senate and Congress are an opposition party to, or the majority is the opposition party to the president, which is usually the case historically, then he's going to have a very difficult time getting his agenda through.
The president is not omnipotent. That's not the claim here, but the president does run and set the national agenda, and their influence is felt throughout the many offices that they control.
So you could say the same thing for Oprah Winfrey. She also, her influence is felt throughout the country. You could say the same thing for David Letterman when he was on the air.
Oprah Winfrey and David Letterman were significant.
Did they run the
Letterman
country?
Letterman was a significant figure in our national life.
Did David
life?
Letterman run the country?
No.
Sounds like that's what you're saying, Healy.
What does David Letterman talk about, not anymore, but what did he talk about in an average monologue? Almost every single night he had a joke about the president. Why? Because the president is setting the national agenda.
He also had a joke like every night about O.J. Simpson when that was going on, but that didn't mean that he was. That has no. I'm not sure what we're arguing anymore.
Here's adding 2 minutes to the clock.
He's adding 2 minutes to the clock.
Wow,
there are far too many people in this country.
Medina runs the debate.
You know what? You know what's funny? Ask presidents themselves if they run the country, and Barack Obama will tell you what he said many times, that being the president is like steering a massive, massive ship, and the only thing you could do is slightly adjust the trajectory of the ship by about 2 degrees.
Okay, those are his words. The captain of the ship runs the ship.
Those are his words.
He's comparing himself to the captain of a ship. He correctly understands his role.
Wrong.
Yes, he's not omnipotent.
You're misunderstanding
the analogy.
He is running
the ship of state.
You're misunderstanding the analogy. He's not comparing himself to the captain of a ship who could easily say, turn around, we're going 180 degrees. The analogy he makes is that you're on a ship with a very limited sort of, it's not the captain of a ship. A captain of a ship can decide where the ship goes. His point is the president of the United States has a 2 degree bandwidth of how much he could steer the ship, which is to me, clearly says that even the presidents acknowledge that they don't run the country. They only have 2 degrees of influence.
His power is not infinite, but he's the guy steering the national ship.
He's
the guy,
one of many guys steering
the direction
also,
it's going to go.
You said that he can influence the economy by appointing people to the Treasury. Those people are actually supposed to be unbound by who the president is.
Can a pilot of a plane just drop the plane in the middle of Iowa on a dime? No, he can't. But the pilot runs the plane. He's flying the plane and directing it. Similarly, the president runs the nation. He can't do every single thing he wants.
Why can't a pilot drop a plane in the middle of Iowa? What are you talking about?
But he does run the nation. He or she runs the country. Sets the agenda, directs the political life of the country, can manipulate the economy in a million large and small ways, directs our armed forces all over the world, sets the global agenda as determined by the president of the United States.
Aside from your misunderstanding of what a pilot does in a plane... Oh, God damn it.
Hot debate.
Why? Well, explain the decision to add 2 minutes.
I just felt like we were having an interesting talk.
What do you think?
Can I tell you what I wanted to hear?
Yeah, of course.
The president runs an administration and tries to kind of stay out of trouble, I think, for the 4 or 8 years that they're in office. It's like Davis is saying, and I wanted a little bit more out of the ship steering ability analogy.
You still got enough.
But you, I mean, yeah, I kind of got to hand it to Davis.
I don't think so.
Do you guys think that was the hottest debate that Room 218 at the Super 8
in Beachwood, Ohio?
Motel in Beachwood, Ohio has ever seen?
We're having motel room debates.
Probably
right.
You're
probably
right.
Are you kidding?
There's probably been physical altercations in the room that we're in.
Yeah,
for sure.
I
over
feel like
far less important subjects.
I'm sure I can see wall damage that's been repaired here.
We're not complaining. Thanks to the RNC for hooking us up.
Great. Awesome. What do you guys actually think? Do you think the president runs the country?
No. I think the president does have a lot of power just through the sort of symbolic role of the office. But like, you remember when Bill Clinton was like, he had to go on TV and be like, oh, the president, I'm still relevant because I'm the president. Mm-hmm. That happens all the time. The president can easily lose control of the country.
Yeah.
Also, I think no one really runs.
There's
the
no
country.
Running. No one There's really no runs. Running of the
yeah.
country.
Right.
What argument would have convinced you, Heels, that the president doesn't run the country?
What argument would have convinced me that the president
I mean, what
run the
what
country?
Argument that Dave could have made
you think he won this debate,
would have
so what
convinced you that
wrong?
He won? What's the winning argument here?
I think the winning argument is that there's a million factors
well, that's
that the
what
president
I was about to get. I was
controlling.
Just, look, if you put another 2 minutes on the clock, that's where I was headed. After I needed to point out that you still don't seem to understand how much they are in control of planes.
I almost think the chairman of the Federal Reserve has...
Yeah,
way
could
more
be.
Power than the
could
president.
Be.
There's a lot of them that vote, right?
Yeah, but I think they can kind of take the helm.
Who's the current Fed chairman? Janet Yellen?
Janet, why, babe?
So you think she's more powerful than Barry O right now?
Well, I think that she could... Well, I don't know about more powerful than Barry O.
We got a lame duck. It's, you know, he's... Now, he is popular, but it's TikTok with this guy. You know?
Yeah, they depend... As it should be in a system like ours, they depend on each other. There's a lot of checks. I mean, the Constitution is designed to keep the president from running the country.
That's right.
There's checks and balances.
It's a great historical lesson.
I think I made a great argument from a tough position. And for that, I think I deserve to win the debate.
I think your argument was pretty basic again.
It was a basic pitch argument.
It's like the army, the economy.
Army, what a snorfest.
The army doesn't have anything to do with running the
country.
No
specifics. You never said, here's when President Reagan ran the country. Here's when Roosevelt. I mean, get
the fuck out of here. President
Roosevelt. Talk about the New Deal.
There was definitely a time when the president ran the country.
When do you think that was?
Before World War II.
Yeah, baby.
I think World War II was probably the time that the president was most running the country.
That's what I mean. Leading up into World War II.
I don't know. You think like Coolidge
and then I think
the
coming out of World War II, industry, commerce, and private enterprise took over.
Well, the Gilded Age of presidents was like their least powerful time, right?
It's clear that private enterprise runs the country now, which is the way it was maybe when we landed over here, right?
Well, it's cyclical. I mean, am I wrong that during the Gilded Age, the president was less powerful than private industry? Like that was sort of the last time when we felt that way as a nation?
Yeah, the Senate was really powerful at that time, and they were basically in the thrall of like corporate interests. I've been reading that Master of the Senate and learning all about this.
That's tight. In my memory, there was a recent time when Simon Cowell was the most powerful person in the country.
He was running American Idol for sure.
I felt like his influence was even greater. I felt like whatever he said went for a while.
What was like something that you think he directed the country to do?
V-neck shirts.
Who do you think was the most powerful person in American history?
Great question. Who are the nominees? George Washington?
George Dubb. Lincoln.
Lincoln.
Rose FDR.
Yeah.
TR.
FDR is possible just because he went buck wild. He made bigger McGovern than
ever.
How about
Jesus Christ?
How about Rockefeller or Astor or Carnegie or
Carnegie's
one of those dudes?
How about Thomas Edison? Sort of a backdoor power.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what happened last night.
Thank you.
It kind of got funky at the end and we had a bizarre encounter. Healy, do you want to talk about this a little bit?
Yeah, the star power wattage at the Republican National Convention is very low.
Oh,
people should. It's just a grim, grim
D-list scene, guys.
I assume at the Democratic Convention we're going to have John Legend,
Lady Gaga.
Tom Hanks probably going to be there. Spielberg,
Dustin Pedroia, probably.
Here's who we're working with at the RNC.
Jason Veritek.
And these are just our suggestions, guys.
These are just our suggestions.
Probably the biggest star we saw was Duck Dynasty Grandpa.
Oh, I didn't see him.
He was there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And we saw Roger Stone, Republican political operative.
We saw Huckabee.
We saw Huckabee
put on a few.
And then we saw Don King.
This is Wednesday night, so this is after the crazy Ted Cruz didn't endorse thing and Mike Pence gave his speech.
Yeah, we went over to Media Row, which is like where all the radio and TV setups are, to see if we could grab any people who would talk to us. And the best we could come up with was Don King. He was mid-interview with a radio guy from Seattle or someplace, and the radio guy was already exhausted by the interview he was having.
Yeah, just it seemed endless. And Medina, what are we about to listen to? Because we recorded some audio.
So as we were waiting for Don King to free up, and really for him to free the journalist, right?
Really, yes.
We recorded a debate.
A loose debate given our proximity to Don King.
So we're going to roll that, and then we'll get into our brief interview of Don King.
We're here waiting for Don King, who's giving a long radio interview. I'm hoping to ask him what a debater can learn from a boxer.
Great question.
I like that.
It's been going on for quite some time. It's hard to know whether this is worth our time or not at this point to wait for him to rant on and on.
We could just pick up the stuff that he's saying to this guy, but the dude is a working journalist. I don't want to steal his interview.
Well, keep in mind, we are not real journalists. We have no idea what the ethics involved here are.
It seems like you don't horn in on a guy's interview,
like,
right?
That would be bad form in some way.
I have a feeling we're going to get a version of the same thing when we talk to him.
I would think so. Do you want to debate right now whether Don King is crazy or not?
Yeah, I think that okay. He is obviously at one time was a very intelligent man who's now suffering from senility and mental decay.
Okay, I'll take the con. I don't think he's crazy. I think he is passionate, and I would say that his...
Did you say compassionate?
No, just passionate. Yes. I think he's passionate, and I would say that the level of vocabulary that he's speaking with demonstrates a certain non-craziness, if you will. And yes, he does repeat himself, but let's not forget that he's of quite some advanced age at this point. I think he's probably in his 70s at least, and I don't think that's...
I think he might be 80.
I don't think he's entered even senility. I think you could say that, yes, he's a bit addled, or not even that. You can hear him. He's so facile with his thoughts and speech.
There is a facility, a skilled rhetoric. I mean, he's vamping.
He's
very
far from anything like...
It's hypnotic.
It is. And it takes a certain quality for him to be able to speak this way. I don't think he's crazy. I think he's unusual. I think he's eccentric.
Well, I think that we're not following any kind of coherent train of thought. His clues are very eccentric, and if this wasn't Don King, you would think it was just basically an unusually articulate homeless person.
But it's certainly not unusual for celebrities to dress in a manner that is a little bit louder or busier than the average person.
Okay, let me paint the scene for you. He's clutching upside-down newspaper.
Well, he actually used the newspaper earlier to demonstrate how he felt a bit betrayed by the Republican Party. This was merely evidence in his arsenal to demonstrate that he had been... He used the phrase inner circle of the Republican Party, and he feels betrayed that he wasn't allowed to speak here.
I'm not sure that he feels betrayed because he still has an enormous Donald Trump pin on his jacket.
Well, he made this very clear, and I actually think, again, this level of thought is illustrative of someone who still has most of his faculties. He said that while he was upset and insulted that he wasn't invited to speak here, he, if anything, is only going to double down on his efforts to support Trump. He believes that he is an excellent person to speak to African Americans and try to get the Trump vote out to them, misguided though he may be. That's what he said. I think it's interesting.
I don't think this is a man who's going to convince any voters.
I don't think you're taking this debate seriously, Ilya. I think, quite frankly, I'm trouncing you right now.
Yeah, I think so, because I've got my eyes on Mr. King. I'm hoping to jump in at any second.
Well, we'll know when he stops talking, that's for sure. I'm not worried about that happening, yeah.
I don't know. There may be like a 1 second when somebody tries to get him out of here.
True, but I don't think we have to worry about anyone else jumping in line ahead of us. Do you want to make a closing statement about why he's not crazy? Or why he is crazy.
I'm taking the side. Well, the other thing is that I'm a little handicapped in the debate because I'm about 4 feet from the man who's been convicted of manslaughter.
That's
and
a great
I'm
point.
Reluctant to talk that's about how crazy he is in a way that you're
shot of a man who stomped another man to death.
Right.
And you, I have asked you to make the case that he is, in fact, crazy. So maybe with that in mind, we'll wrap up the debate right here and agree that we both did a valiant job today.
Okay, look, I didn't do the best job in that debate because I was afraid because I was standing 3 feet away from a murderer and I didn't want to talk about how crazy he is.
Right.
But then we had a chance to talk to Mr. King, and listeners can decide for themselves if he's crazy or not.
I would say, more accurately, he had a chance to talk to us.
That's true.
And here's what happened. Correct.
We're from a podcast called The Great Debates, and what we do is have debates on different issues of the day. Is there anything that you have learned from your career in boxing that you think could help a debater?
Stick and move.
Stick and move. Good advice. Stick and move.
You know, you don't, just because a guy disagrees with you, that don't make him evil. You know what I mean? You got to be able to bring understanding and upward mobility and elevation. And to be able to win, you have to be a great counterpuncher. That's why I support the unity of the people's will of choice in Donald Trump. He's a fighter. And his whole campaign has been based on boxing. You know, making the move. You got to be able to, you know, you got to say what Muhammad Ali do. Say, what did he say? Float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. Your hands can't hit what your eyes can't see. I'm so fast I can turn the light out and get in the bed before it's dark.
What do you think are Hillary Clinton's talents as a debater?
I think she's great.
Okay. So he's crazy.
I don't think so.
Wait.
He's pretty articulate.
We're flipping?
Yeah, I don't think he's crazy. I mean, I think he's pretty, you know, he's not as sharp as he maybe once was, but I think he's pretty articulate for like an 80-year-old guy.
That was the point I was making.
Yeah. And okay. That was just a debate, Dave. You know we don't always debate our real feelings.
No, we rarely do.
Debate.
Hey, let's lighten the mood.
Please.
What do you think?
Great idea.
Because we were talking so much about politics and Don King and the president.
I know.
Can we take a break from
can we just have a little
convention crap
light,
for a
the lighter side?
Yeah. Let's do a couple, three guys chilling in a motel room.
Yeah.
Pass the time. What do you got, Heels?
I've come up with a new game, and I'd like to challenge Dave to play it.
I love a good game.
The game is called Tough Impressions.
Oh.
I'm going to throw out a name that I think is a fairly tough impression to do.
Okay. This is a nerve-wracking
You're
game.
A pretty good impressionist.
Wait,
think
are
we're
we all doing this?
Well, you can serve some back to me afterwards, but first you're going to play. Are you ready?
Davis, you're
I'll
good
try.
At, you're really good at impressions.
Thank you for puffing me up.
First impression.
Uh-huh.
David Spade.
Oh. Can I say briefly? David Spade. I'm sorry I said Spade like that. David Spade was just a guest actor on Love this season, and he was awesome and the nicest dude, so I don't want this to sound like I'm...
Oh, so this is an easy... This is just an impression of your coworker.
I don't want it to sound like I'm making fun of him at all, because I love him. He was great.
Man, if there's anybody who has done a ton of impressions of other people and should be able to take a lick, it's
That's
David
fair.
Spade.
Okay, here we go. Ready? David Spade. So, hey, Pally. We were hanging out at the Chateau Marmont. And this chick was talking to him, and we went to the bathroom for a little. I don't know. That's all. I don't. It's,
great.
Okay. Very good.
What score would you give him out of 12, Dan?
I would give him a 9.5.
Yeah, I think so. I think he earned it.
I think that was. I'm not convinced that was a difficult impression, just because of how well he did.
We're gonna do 3.
Okay.
Okay.
Are you ready for another?
If you had asked me to do an impression of David Spade's stand-up concert from like HBO that was on the air in 1997, I probably could have given you about 30 minutes of it because I loved it.
So it turns out that was a very easy impression.
I don't know about that.
No,
I never thought about actually doing
impressionist.
It.
Impressionist.
All right, give me another one.
Katie Couric.
Wow.
The game's called Tough Impression, bro.
Jesus
it's
Christ.
It's not called softballs.
What? I mean, all right, give me a second to think about this.
Katie Couric.
It's called Tough Impression.
It's
what can I tell
difficult.
You?
I mean, I don't even know what register her voice is in. This is ridiculous.
You can pass if you want.
No. No, I accept the challenge.
I love this.
While it's not a subject that many of us would like to talk about, colon cancer kills more than 6 million people a year. Now, that, I don't know.
Yeah, that's a topic she talks about. She has a kind of warm, motherly thing going on.
I can't even hear her
it's
voice.
It's a tough impression.
I'll say.
Medina, tough. Score out of 12. For
I'm going to have to go with a 6 there.
That was worse than a 6. That was a 0. That was nothing. I put no spin on it. It was garbage.
Okay, well, it was very tough.
And I 50, also...
50% is a failing grade, bro.
Yeah, that's true.
All right, are you ready for another tough impression?
No, but go ahead.
Papa Smurf.
I have no idea what he sounds. I have literally no idea what he sounds like.
Okay, you can pass.
I pass.
Papa Smurf. Okay.
He sounds like a crotchety old man.
Can you do a Papa Smurf impression?
Well, my little Smurflings, we'll go and gather mushrooms.
It's more or less that.
I don't know if that was accurate or not.
That's kind of like that.
I want listeners to tweet about Healy's Papa Smurf. Please.
Okay. Hashtag Healy Smurf.
Are you ready for another?
Hashtag Healy Smurf.
Tough impression.
Yes.
Yeah.
Tina Fey.
Why are you doing this, man?
Women are hard.
It's tough. It's called Tough Impressions, guys. Do you want to play or not?
I wish there were fewer women. They're harder to do for me.
You want to pass? I'll give you a man.
Yeah, give me a man.
Joe Biden.
Joe Biden.
Yeah.
Joe Biden is also
okay. All right, that's a tough impression.
What is the thread of the tough impression?
Just people I could think of that are tough to impersonate. That
is it
aren't
because
easy.
They don't have like a. Exaggerated.
They had to be like A-list celebrities that you spend a lot of time experiencing.
All right, this is like you've probably seen this YouTube video of Joe Biden.
Okay, yeah.
This is what I'm drawing from. Is that mom? Come here, mom. Smile that lights up the room. Look at her, beautiful.
Great.
How was that?
Very
nine,
good.
9 or 10.
I'm giving him an 8, but it was good.
8 only?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, it didn't. It's hard to hear Joe Biden's voice in your head, right?
Yeah. And without the physicality of it,
it's tough.
Okay, well, fair is fair. I will play if you are going to make me.
Oh, I'll give you this I think is an easier impression,
okay.
But I think for you...
It's tough.
It's still... Ready?
Okay.
Golf handicap style.
Yeah. Coach of the New England Patriots, Bill Belichick.
Ooh.
Okay, we went out there. We tried to do our job. Everybody told me we had a good game. Tried to get out there and hit the tackle. My next question.
All right. Not bad.
Thank you.
Not bad.
Thank you.
I don't really have a picture of him in my mind, but I was convinced by that.
He has a little bit more of a vocal fry thing, actually.
But like the cadence was right.
We're going to focus on the Chargers. I believe I answered that question already.
Next week, we're looking at the Packers. We're not going to talk about that anymore.
We have to focus on offense, defense, and special teams. I believe I've answered all the other questions. We're going to focus on Cincinnati. Should I give you one more, Healy?
I'll take one more, yeah.
Okay, I've got to think of someone here.
It's not an easy game to think of the impressions or do them.
Maybe a sign that it's not a great game.
It's a very challenging game.
Yeah. Not very rewarding.
A challenging game is still a good game.
I'm entertained. Challenging, my friend.
Entertainment is its own reward.
Yeah. Stephen Colbert.
Ooh.
Okay, give me 1 second. We're at the Republican National Convention. Donald Trump is here. Now, here's the thing about Mr. Trump. You have to wonder what kind of C-minus Harold Hill is running for president of the United States.
I didn't love it. It made me uncomfortable.
Okay.
It was louder than it needed to be.
I think Colbert gets loud.
Uh-huh. Maybe.
Yeah.
It's sure. A tough. It's very tough.
Tough impression.
I would say it was a little bit better than my Katie Couric.
Thank you.
But worse than everything else.
It wasn't
so it's
great.
A seven.
And it was it gave me a sour taste in my mouth to end on.
I didn't feel satisfied with it.
Yeah.
It was a seven.
Hey, sorry.
Dino, throw out one more that Dave and I will both try.
Tough impression battle.
Okay. Tom Petty.
Oh, okay. That's cool.
Does he have to be talking?
I think he has to be talking.
Okay.
How about give us a Tom Petty situation?
No, I'm going.
Oh,
ready?
Go.
It's good to be back in Inglewood, man. This is where it all started. Anything could happen tonight.
See, when we were just starting out, you wanted to get a guitar and a couple guys together and just kind of play the songs that you knew how to play and rock that room. That was all you were trying to do.
Mm. What was that?
I think it's a King 7 Healy 4.
Oh, damn it. I love Tom Petty, too.
My impression was based on a real experience where I saw him at the Forum.
Yeah.
And he said, this is where it all started. He said, I think he said even something like, we got a lot of friends in the house tonight or something like that. And he said, this is the last show on our tour. Anything could happen tonight. Mm. And Bruce Hornsby opened up for him.
Okay, what happened?
Nothing.
Oh.
He just played his songs and left the stage. No guests, no covers, nothing. It was still cool. It was a fun time.
Okay, enough messing around. It's been cool to hang in the hotel room here. Sorry, motel room. But let's go to the convention.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Let's get out of here.
Okay.
Okay, so we're in an Uber.
Okay.
On the way from Beechwood to Cleveland. And I thought it might be fun to rip a debate.
Might as well. Right?
Yeah, why not? Let's do something.
Okay. Topic, Healy taking the pro. Front seat is better than the back seat.
I'm Steve Healy. I'm taking the pro. Simple. You've got a great big window. You can see more. You also have control over your seat. You can move the seat back as you see fit, as I shall do now. And get myself a bit more room.
Ooh.
The back seat is basically a prisoner. You're trapped back there. You're hopeless.
Okay, here's what just happened. You just sandwiched Medina's legs like I've never seen.
I'm proving also, how bad the back seat is.
Yeah, but now you've just caused a conflict with one of your best friends. I mean, this is awful. As soon as this debate's over, Medina's going to be like, can you move the seat forward? This sucks. I'm pinned back here. Also,
she's going to be sitting here thinking how crummy it is to be in the back seat.
Hold on for a second. Let's look at the actual square footage of our windows. You're talking about a big old front seat window. In fact, my window is much larger than yours. Also,
look at all the
leg room I have. I'd be able to stretch my knees
from
basically 180 degrees, whereas your knees are ending up, you've already hit you're trying to stretch as far as you can, and the best you can do is less than 90 degrees. Look at that.
Well, that's because my legs are a lot longer, dummy.
Well, all the more reason why
why you should understand the value of the back seat. Look at how much room I have here for my legs. You have far less room than
mine. This is cute. It's cute what you're doing, but obviously I can see a lot more. I have a lot more control over my circumstances. I can see where I'm going a lot easier. I don't feel imprisoned. I don't feel like a child. I feel like a participant in the journey we're taking. The front seat is better than the back
seat. I couldn't disagree more. I feel like I'm taken care of. I feel like I'm secure. I feel like I don't have to worry at all.
You love to be babied. We have to talk about universals, not your particular sense of enjoying being a swaddle baby.
Here's a universal. You take the we're talking about for passengers, right? Yeah. Can we stipulate that? Here's what happens if you take the front seat. Hey, can you tell me?
Why do people call shotgun? Everybody calls shotgun. Nobody ever calls backseat.
Here's what happens. The driver ends up saying, shit, can you look on the map? They used to call shotgun, less so. Now people want the backseat because they know that
if you're in the passenger seat,
every single person you're going to have to get out your map. You're going to have to help the driver. It's going to be a pain in the ass.
Fun. You're part of the trip.
I don't want to be navigator. I want to be passenger.
You're lazy.
No, I'm not lazy.
You have a preference for being a swaddle baby. You like to be in the back seat because you feel like a little kid. But everybody else in the world is calling shotgun because they want to be up front with the action.
What sensation in the world is there? They're being able to sit down and feel like you're taken care of and feel like a child again.
It's to feel like a participant, to feel like you're helping the project.
If I fall asleep, so what?
I can fall asleep easily up here. I can even put my feet up on the dashboard.
There is no way that you could get your feet up on this dashboard, and there's no way that you could even recline, because if you do, you're going to break Medina's knees right now.
Well, that's tough for Medina. He's in the back seat.
Okay, it's time for closing statements. I'll start. The guy who calls
for closing statements is always the guy who's losing the debate.
I'll keep going. You want to keep going?
No, do your closing statement. I'm just pointing it out. For debate analysts, they've already picked up on this.
Here's the main value of the back seat is the enormous amount of room that you have, and also the idea that you do not have to worry about where you're going. Unless you are an annoying quote-unquote backseat driver, which you don't have to be, you can just sit back, relax. You could lie down if you want to.
This is one of your weakest debates ever. You've literally argued two opposite things, that the room is better in the back seat and that I'm squashing Medina with the freedom that I have to expand or contract my amount of room however much I like.
Well, that's because you're an inconsiderate jerk who just moved your seat back without asking Medina. I mean, I've never seen anything like that.
Here's my closing statement. There's a way that the world works. It's people call shotgun because they want to be up front. Everybody knows that the front is better. Lead from the front. The back seat is for losers.
Deans, what'd you think?
Gotta be honest, I wasn't really paying attention because I was sitting in the back seat here looking out the window.
Yeah.
But Healy won the debate at the end. I heard it come through loud and clear. Now, that doesn't mean I agree with him. Just means he won.
Do you think that the winner or loser of the debate does it really come down to arguments or just sort of like spirit and like who feels like they're winning?
I think it's
like who's conveying victory more.
I used to think that, but I don't think that anymore.
I would be curious to see how often the person who speaks the most wins the debate. I think that might be...
We need to get Nate Silver in on
yeah,
on
we
the
need
great
to.
Debates.
I want to run some variable. I want to run some, regression analysis of different variables. Here are the variables. How much time do you speak? What's the maximum volume of each debater?
Yep.
And maybe what's the highest pitch, literally, on a tonal scale?
Yeah.
I think there's some other factors.
If there's any sort of like statistically minded, Nate Silver kind of aspiring / audio spectrum analysis enthusiasts out there.
What a description. I hope there's a person like that somewhere.
Our listenership, please get in touch with us. We'd love you to run some regressions and some other analyses. I think the back seat is much better than the front seat.
Really?
Yeah. And here's why. It's like I'm in my own private world back here. I'm being chauffeured. More shenanigans might happen in the back seat than in the front.
Shenanigans.
The front seat is always worried, like, what are they talking about back there?
I feel like Dave did leave on the table the argument of, like, feeling like you're being chauffeured.
Mm-hmm.
I was prepared to rebut that.
But I said you feel like it. I mean, to me, the greatest sensation in the world is when you're a child and you fall asleep in the car and then you get home and then the sensation is your dad or your mom picks you up while you're asleep and carries you inside. And that to me is what the backseat evokes.
Yeah, you're chauffeured. You're being chauffeured. You're being taken care of.
You didn't say that in the debate. That was a great image that you could have. You could have.
I like being chauffeured, like in there. The sense of like feeling like you're in a powerful tycoon in the back of a town car, you know?
The back suite is more feng shui than the front seat, I think.
Hey, you know who was riding in the front seat? Who you wouldn't think.
No, who?
Senator Bob Dole.
Oh, so, and I'll tell you who's riding in the back seat. John F. Kennedy. Didn't work out too well for him. All right, let's wrap up this micro.
That was fun. Okay, we're on our way to Cleveland.
Okay, so we're inside the queue. Chairman Priebus talking right now. We're going to just rip a quick debate. And the topic is, almost all of these people are nice.
Steve Healy, I'm taking the pro. Nice is a pretty superficial word and a superficial label, and almost all these people follow it. They're polite. They're civil to each other. They stand in line. They're excited about the United States. They're gracious to one another. They're civil. They speak kindly to each other. They're kind to strangers. They're basically nice. Now, in their hearts, who knows? I can't tell you, but if you encountered any one of them one-on-one, as I have several times over the course of the convention, you're going to find that almost all of them are nice.
Not 5 minutes ago, I was outside in the corridors of this hall, and a woman was denied entry into a section of the arena which she did not have security clearance for. And she went off on this woman who was just doing her job. This is asinine. I was here before. I don't understand what's going on. She was rude. She was entitled. She was anything but nice. Now, does that go for everyone here? Of course not. But I want to make another larger point, which is that these are people who are politically driven. And I'm not saying that even necessarily because they're Republican, but rather because these are politically minded people, that these are opportunists. These are people who are self-motivated. These are people who are for whom niceness is not a priority. And I would add only my third point, which is that the rhetoric we are hearing in this convention is so anti. It is so negative. It is so, listen to what we're hearing right now, boos for Hillary Clinton. It is so single-mindedly opposed to the candidacy of Hillary Clinton. That is almost the sole idea that we keep hearing. And that to me is like, just suggests that there is a deep-seated hostility and negativity to these people here. And I would say far from all of these people are nice.
Okay, let me go through this point by point. Because first of all, you have one example of somebody not being nice. And I don't know what to say to that.
I thought it adds a little color.
I don't know what to say to that except that the thousands of other people we've come across have been totally nice.
I would say that
just at the bar on the way here, some people just started a conversation with us about their sister's wedding.
I don't think we've given most of these people a fair test as to whether or not they're nice.
The test is, can they come together in this convention hall and be respectful to each other? Hang on. Now, the next point that you made is that these people are politically motivated. Look, sure, you can look at that in a dark, cynical way, as you're inclined to do always.
I'd love to.
But you could also look at it as, like, these people have taken time out of their lives to work for what they think is a better America. Just because you don't agree with it doesn't mean that it's dark or sinister.
But my point is not that.
As for the negative rhetoric, actually, we haven't heard that at all. We've heard a lot of rhetoric about togetherness and unity. It may not be exactly what you picture or what you want.
They chanted, lock her up.
Yeah, they don't like Hillary Clinton because they think she's a...
Lock her up. They chanted All Lives Matter and lock her
up. These people think that Hillary Clinton is a criminal and they're working their asses off to keep her from becoming the president. They're trying their hardest to prevent what they think is a criminal takeover of the United States.
Let's go back to one of the earlier points here, which is about the politically minded people. And you say that they're taking time out of their lives to work to make America better. My point is that there is not a strong correlation between that type of person and niceness. I'm not saying that... I agree with you. In their minds, they think they're being altruistic. They think they're here to help every American reach up from their bootstraps and become the best American they can be. But
they're essentially volunteers. Most of these people... This convention is built on the backs of volunteers.
Are you kidding me? Everyone is here because they are self-interested in a higher position.
Dave, that's just not true. That's just not true. This is being organized by volunteers from Cleveland. Most of the delegates are paying their own expenses. These people are working for a cause they believe in. Now, you may not like it, you may not agree with it, and that's fine. You're welcome not to.
I have not once said anything about the actual Republican platform that I think, other than, again, the rhetoric. Now, if we want to get to that point, that the Republican platform is built largely on hate, on on exclusion, then I'm willing to go down that road because I think it's absolutely true. And I think that the type of people who are drawn to that platform and the type of people who like to be vocal about it are probably people who are less likely to be nice. I would also add that, like, I'm actually surprised how few people have said to me something like, how's it going? Or like, hey, are you enjoying, like, the vendors here, they didn't say anything. They were, like, miserable. They didn't say, like, you having a good time? Like, the Uber drivers have been the nicest people I've dealt with, and they're not here. People in the convention, in fact, just before this happened, a dude looked me up and down, clearly thought I was a terrorist. I don't blame him, but he clearly thought there was something wrong with me, and he would, like, inspect my security pass on a level of scrutiny that I've never seen.
Okay.
And he didn't even glance at yours.
Okay, you're dressed disgracefully, and you're shaggy, and you look terrible. You didn't bring any respect to this convention. You're the one who's
exact same clothes right now.
There's one guy who's not being nice here, and it's you. You look like a hippie, and you came to this convention to sneer at it and be a snob about it. You're the one who's not being nice.
Okay, that's
these
one.
People are working
well,
together
one.
To build a better country.
Okay, well, if what we're trying to prove is, I'm trying to prove the con of almost everyone here is nice. You've just given me one person who isn't nice. So I asked the listener to define the terms of what does almost all of the people mean, and if it's maybe that could mean more than one. You've got one in me already.
I think your vinegar persona is maybe bringing you into other unkind
people.
What's the
nicest thing you've
heard
someone here
say? But I'm walking
through
here and seeing people just be friendly and civil and nice to each other. As for the vendors, these people are deeply overworked. They're trying to serve chicken fingers to like 18,000 people.
Yeah.
They're doing the best they can. I've actually found them to be pretty nice, considering. They're preoccupied, but they're not going out of their way to like talk to me about my life because they're busy making my chicken fingers for me.
Wrong again. They were out of chicken fingers, and you know it as well as I do. And when I was given the news that they were out of chicken fingers, the tone was not, I'm so sorry we're out of chicken fingers. It was no chicken fingers. And then the woman I was dealing with even was like, I said, I'm sorry there are no chicken fingers, because I thought she said that to someone else, and I overheard. I said, there are no chicken fingers. She goes, that's what I'm told, but I can't even understand what they're trying to tell me in the kitchen.
She's frustrated. She's at her wit's end. That doesn't mean she's not a nice person.
Well, she wasn't nice in the moment. Look, let's get back to the square point. Look around here. This is a fucking white power rally. And to say anything other is like, I think you know that you'd be lying if you said that you would normally never associate with these people, in part because they are like single-minded in their hatred for most of the quote-unquote others in this country.
Look,
and that in itself is not nice in a sort of politeness way. I'm going for a deeper niceness, a kindness. And I think these people are deeply unkind.
I began this debate by saying that niceness is a superficial quality. That's how we're defining niceness.
That's how you're
defining
niceness.
And most of these
people
have that.
You can't just say that's how we're defining these things.
Sure I can. That's the prerogative of the pro.
I don't think it's nice to chant build a wall. I don't think it's nice to come
to somebody else's convention and make a mockery of it, which is what you're doing.
You're the one who invited me. You're the one who got the press passes. Don't put this on me, man.
Adina, what do you think?
Yeah. You're right. It's not nice to chant "build a wall," Davis. But I think by and large everyone here is pretty nice and having a good time. Why don't we conclude this after the convention?
Oh man, we're back at the Super 8. What a harrowing experience that was.
That was rough.
It was just sad and depressing.
It was worse than I ever imagined.
It didn't make me feel good at all.
I didn't think it wasn't that much worse than I expected it to be, but at the same time, it really took a piece out of us just to watch that sort of hate and rhetoric. And
did you expect to be rocked to that extent, even though you expected it to be kind of bad?
I guess I didn't think about the emotional toll that that kind of thing would take on me. We should point out that we're all lying in bed right now.
Yeah, sleepy time debates.
It's time for sleepy time debates. Healy and I are in the same bed. Healy's cranky. I asked if I could turn and face him during the debate, and he said no. He says he's not mad at me, but he wouldn't let me address him directly.
I mean, just to recap a little bit, I have never seen anything like that before. It was like a fascist rally.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, the scariest word I heard tonight was Americanism. Americanism, not globalism.
Horrible.
It was like, jingoistic doesn't begin to describe it.
I have thought this whole thing was kind of funny up until the moment that he took the stage.
Yeah.
And then it got really real, really fast.
One thing that bums me out is that it's clear that, like, making fun of Trump or, like, pointing out how ridiculous he is has zero effect.
Right.
It has the wrong effect.
I sort of thought maybe, like, we were doing something helpful by, like, no. being satirical or, like, reporting on his ridiculousness. But no. We need to think of a new tactic.
I think we're complicit.
The Jon Stewart career did nothing for us.
I think we owe the American people a small apology for being complicit.
Well, it's not too late to turn it around.
Now I'm interested in getting in being active.
Yeah, for sure. So right? Let's take that as the positive.
I think that's correct. I think we should all get active.
How are we going to do that?
Well, first we're going to debate.
Okay.
Like, that's a good start, I think.
Let's take America's mind off the horror show of Donald Trump.
Great idea.
With a nice sleepy time debate.
I have a great, great sleepy time debate topic, I think.
Great.
Healy taking the pro. Okay, here we go. It's like thinking of a bedtime story.
Yep.
Okay, the topic is dreams are significant.
I'm Steve Healy. I'm taking the pro. Dreams are incredible. They're generated by your subconscious. They often draw on deep, deep memories that you have consciously forgotten. They often play out in some bizarre kind of mask emotional issues that you're working through. It's not often clear when you wake up. The dream usually fades pretty quickly. For a long time, ever since I read in a book that if you write down your dreams, you'll remember them. Like, if you immediately write them down, you'll just have a better memory of your dreams. So I've had that practice for at least 10 years or so, and I have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages of my dreams logged. Not in any detailed way, but I've just found, like, exploring them and thinking about your dreams will pretty much always yield something of significance, whether it's a memory or a feeling you're not totally processed or a reflection on a character. If nothing else, it just is a significant in that it shows you how generative and powerful your subconscious mind is, and is a almost daily reminder of the huge, huge hidden powers of your brain and how much is going on in your brain that's not conscious and not easily accessible to you. And so it's humbling and enlightening and just a good way to get in touch with the huge powers that are beyond the reach of your consciousness.
So I was close to sleeping already, and now I'm basically like in REM sleep from your opening statement.
It was perfect.
So long. A lot of facts about sleeping that seem to have not a lot to do with whether or not dreams are significant, but kudos on your awesome journal. That was really interesting.
I hate you.
Healy, that was just, look, keep it in the confines of the debate. Whether or not you keep a dream journal or not, and like whatever you read in a book about writing it down, that's not relevant to the fact of whether dreams are significant or not.
Dave, it is. It's relevant because it's
I'm explaining cranky.
How we learn about our dreams. I'm telling you my experience with dreams. I take dreams seriously. If you don't, then make a case for why we shouldn't, but I think I made a pretty strong case for the significance of dreams.
Dreams are the runoff of the brain. What dreams are doing is your brain just like being able to get through a little bit of stuff. It kind of fires through some images that aren't necessarily connected. A lot of it's like detritus just kind of working its way through, the same way your liver just kind of processes some stuff and spits out the bad stuff. I'm not saying that dreams are bad stuff.
A movie starring people that are composites and actual characters from your life that you may have forgotten about, that have elaborate sets, dramas, plots, emotional resonances. There can be music, color schemes. There's the dreams are one of the most underexplored and powerful things in human life. I can't believe how little attention we paid to dreams. Ancient people did a much better job of paying attention to dreams. They were very well understood in the Bible and mythology. It's very well understood that dreams are a significant source of wisdom. They're just a powerful thing. Why would you throw that away? I don't understand.
You're basing your argument on like important dreams that you remember, but the reality is that most dreams are A, totally forgotten and not even remembered at all.
That's because you're not writing them down in a journal.
No, that's not true. Healy, you know that even of the dreams that you've written, for every one dream that you wrote down in your journal, there's like 10 dreams that you had while you were sleeping that you never had a chance to remember because they're just fluttering through your brain while you sleep and you don't wake up immediately after having them.
If I could catch them all, I think that would be all the more wisdom. You know, I don't watch every baseball game or every TV show, but like the ones that I catch, I like.
I get that, but my point is that something that you don't even, that you can't apply significant, you can't assign significance to something that you have no, that you don't even remember what it even was. It's like saying it's actually kind of absurd now to think about it. If we all agree that like most of your dreams are not remembered, and I believe that basically like neuroscientists have basically proven that to be true, then how could you argue that dreams are significant? Like I'll go along with the idea that yes, occasionally you have a dream that has like strong emotional resonance, but I would also say that of the dreams you remember, which again, main point, those are only like 5 or 10% of the total dreams you have, some of the dreams you remember, a lot of them are just kind of like junk, or like I'll have dreams where like just because I was sleeping on my back or something, I'll dream that I'm like falling out a window. Well, that's not significant at all. That's just because I don't like sleeping on my back.
Even if you don't remember them, they can still have a lot of significance in helping.
Tell me about a dream that tell me about a dream that you don't remember and explain to me how it was significant.
Because I was working out something, it just
so let's hear about one specific example of a dream that you don't remember.
Dave, don't be ridiculous. Obviously, if I can't remember it, you can't remember it. But that doesn't mean that your mind hasn't taken some use to it. Maybe you don't wake up with some new wisdom that you didn't have before.
Tell me about some wisdom you had from a dream you don't remember. Tell me about the wisdom you woke up with once, Healy, that was from a dream that you don't remember. It seems like it happens so regularly that you must be filled with anecdotes. You're the guy with the dream journal. You're the guy who thinks that they're so important and significant, and yet, and you telling me that regularly the dreams you don't remember give you your brain works through something, then you wake up with a new piece of wisdom.
Do you never wake up with new perspective? Are you so limited that that never happens to you?
Oh, of course I do, but that's okay, usually
from... maybe that's from your dreams. You don't even know.
Neither do you.
Done. I'm done with this debate.
Wow. Well, I'd like to make a closing statement.
Okay.
I'm going to put on my sleep apnea mask. Just hold on a second.
You don't want to make a statement?
I'll make one after Dave does.
Okay.
After this, I'm going to sleep. Hold on, I got to fire it up. Oh, there it goes. Most of the dreams that you have are not even remembered by your brain. So you can't apply... I've said this already, but I feel that it's... This is the argument that I stumbled upon, which I believe to be the best one. If most of the dreams are totally forgotten, then they almost by definition can't be significant. On top of that, a large percentage of the dreams that we end up that we do remember are actually just kind of like really either like image-based in some way that doesn't have any kind of like real resonance with our life. I mean, you're painting a picture where like every dream we have leads you to wake up and go like, oh, this person in my life is important to me in a profound way, and I totally didn't have that perspective. But oftentimes dreams are just like...
It doesn't have to be that simple.
I really wish you would respect the rules of the debate, even if we're doing sleepy time debates. That's because I'm respecting the notion of sleepy time debates. I want this to be the last words I say before I sleep. I'll let you go, Healy. Go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah.
We know that scientists who've studied dreams, they're very mysterious, and so that doesn't mean that they're not significant. We think that this forefront of researchers' dreams think that it has something to do with processing memory. So even a dream that you don't remember is your brain doing some kind of filing system, putting it somewhere. So the topic isn't every dream is significant. The topics of dreams are significant. As we've talked about, there are a lot of dreams that can give you a lot of insight, the ones that you remember. You can cultivate your remembering of your dreams, as I have done. But you can also just, like, you know, the dreams that you don't remember are part of your brain's forming yourself. That's how you're being. It's a one of the ways in which you're making you. So in that way, dreams are significant.
I agree with Healy.
Well, I agree with Healy too, but who won the debate?
That's the question. What I mean. I agree with Healy winning the debate.
I'd really prefer if you said, like, the winner is Healy or something. Of course, dreams are significant.
No, the winner is Healy.
Okay, fine, whatever. I'm going to bed.
It's true, though. He did a nice job.
I thought he did fine, but I mean, like, he had the obviously correct side.
You did mockery in your debate, which cost you points.
You were doing a ton of mockery, Dave. It was not cool.
I'll do the moderating, Healy. I'll do the moderating, David.
I don't think I mocked him. I poked fun at him a little bit.
You clearly mocked him, and that costs you points whenever you mock. So you got to be careful with that.
What are we talking about when I was like, name a dream that you don't remember? That's when I mocked him?
No, you started to mock him and you made a funny voice. And it wasn't very nice.
You started by telling me I was cranky.
You were. You still are.
Sarcastic voice.
When did I use sarcastic voice?
It was when you used sarcastic voice in your closing statement that you did the mocking. Anyway, guys, what a long journey this has been. Both in actual distance from our homes and just like the mental distance we've traveled. I feel so exhausted, but I think it was worth it for us to see this. It was a real it was something that I'll remember. Healy, you were talking earlier about making history.
Oh, yeah. I think people throw around the idea of making history too much.
I agree with you.
Everything that happens is part of history.
Sure.
Serena Williams wins her seventh Wimbledon, makes history with her seventh Wimbledon. Yeah, but it would make history if she lost. That's all true. Part of history.
I agree.
Hillary Clinton will make history when she becomes the... It was prompted by seeing CNN say, so Hillary Clinton's going to make history when she becomes the first female presidential nominee, whatever. Like, yeah, it would make history if they nominated John Kerry again. That's all history.
But surely you understand that language is fluid and that idiom making history generally means something is happening for the first time, right?
I think we're throwing it around way too much too often about everything.
Mm-hmm. It's okay. Like breaking news on CNN.
Yeah, we broke it.
Doesn't bother me. I guess I'm just more of a sort of relaxed, chill guy.
I'm sorry I said I hate you. In that moment, I didn't
believe
that.
Healy, I'm glad that you apologize. That makes me feel better.
It makes me feel better, too. Guys, the CPAP is really kicking in right now.
That's cool, man.
It ramps up slowly so that as you fall asleep, it gives you a little more.
Okay, everybody. Good night from Cleveland. We had a fun time at the convention, and now we're going to go to sleep.
The Great Debates is produced by Mark Caracello. Our audio engineer is Mackenzie Kellerman. The theme song was composed by Christopher Knight. The debaters are Steve Healy and Dave King, and the podcast is moderated by Dan Medina.